It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
In tonight's This Week in History, I'm taking you back to 1969, to a massive concert that descended into murder and mayhem. Now, for many people, the disaster at the Free Altamont Speedway concert near San Francisco on December the 6th, 1969, signalled the end of the 60s hippie dream. The Rolling Stones were headlining and Hell's Angels were invited. What could go wrong? Well, much of the violence was caught on camera for the documentary Gimme Shelter that was released a year later. Now, just take a listen as things start to go off the rails. Now, you can hear the unrest in the crowd as violence breaks out between the Hell's Angels and fans right in front of the stage. And then Mick Jagger halts the song to talk to the crowd.
Hey, people, sisters, brothers and sisters, brothers and sisters. Come on now. That means everybody just cool out.
But then the Rolling Stones kept playing, and by the end of that night, four people had been killed. How did the Altamont concert go so badly wrong? And was it really the death knell for the peace and love generation? Well, to consider these questions for you tonight, we've got Joe Selvin with us. Joel is a rock journalist. He's written a book about Altamont and the inside story of rock's darkest day. Hey, Joel, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, Suzanne. Good to be here.
Now, look, Woodstock had happened earlier in 1969, and I think looking back, Woodstock's kind of seen as the epitome of the peace, hippie, free love, music movement. Was that still all those vibes still sort of very strong in the States at the end of the year?
Well, Woodstock left a tremendous sort of cloud across the country, a pink cloud, to be sure. People thought that this extraordinary event had taken place and the rain and the mud and everything had been so peaceful and wonderful. And that thought lingered. It doesn't really match the reality of the Woodstock Festival. They came so close to having a disaster there. I mean, for one thing, they broke down the fences and turned it into a free festival. They blocked the interstate highway. The first thing the crowd did was burn down the hot dog stand because they objected to the prices. And Governor Rockefeller very seriously considered sending in the National Guard. Can you imagine if he had sent in the National Guard, what Woodstock would have been thought of?
Okay, so this idea that Woodstock and Altamont are completely different ends of the spectrum, it could have been much closer if things had gone slightly more wrong at Woodstock. Now, look, talk to us, though, about why the Rolling Stones wanted to do this concert at Altamont in December 1969. What was going on for them?
So it's a complicated situation and difficult to understand from this vantage point. But the Rolling Stones were out of money, and they had a difficult situation with their management, and they determined the best possible way to raise money was a tour of the United States. They had not been on tour for 3 years, and they booked a very expensive tour and made the promoters pay for it in advance because they really didn't have any money. And there was a lot of sort of hippie era thing about commercial enterprises like concerts, and free concerts were a very popular item then. So there was a lot of pressure on the Rolling Stones to do a free concert. At the same time, there was this whole Woodstock thing in the air. That was August, and the Stones showed up in the United States for that tour in November, late October. And they started talking about doing a free concert. It was just air. It was hot air. And they roped in the Grateful Dead thinking, well, these people, who they didn't know how to do free concerts. And the original plan was for the Grateful Dead to do a free concert with the Stones as special guests in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. But that sort of fell apart as they tried to go down the road towards this. And, you know, also, the Stones were making a movie of this concert tour. And I really think that Mick Jagger was seduced by the idea of having this giant Woodstock-sized crowd as a extras, unpaid extras to their concert movie. When the tour was over, there was no concert scheduled, although Mick Jagger had announced the date. He says, we're going to do a concert on December 6th, somewhere near San Francisco. It came together, the Saturday concert. The planning started on Tuesday. On Wednesday, they found one location. On Thursday, they lost that location and found another location. And late Thursday afternoon, they started moving staging and gear to the new location, which is the Altamont Speedway, about 60 miles east of San Francisco on a hillside. Oh, gosh, in the middle of nowhere, really. You know, Tracy, California was the nearest city. And that they threw that concert together, staging all of it in 36 hours. They were still wrapping cables for the sound system when they started playing at noon.
Now, there's a colorful character, Joel, who keeps coming up in the lead up called John James. Who was he and how was he involved?
Ah, John James. What fascinating character he was. John James showed up when the Stones got to Los Angeles to begin planning their tour. And he told them that he worked for Chrysler Motors and could get them free cars. He told Chrysler Motors he worked for the Rolling Stones and could get them some endorsements. It's not clear what he really did, but he ingratiated himself in the Stones and ended up being one of the people that was calling the shots and running the behind the scenes. Now, years later, it turns out that this guy was probably in the witness protection program and operating under a pseudonym.
Oh, my goodness. Joel Selvin is here. Joel's the author of Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hell's Angels, and The Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day. So the Hell's Angels and their presence as security at Altamont is something that, of course, has gone down in history. How did that arrangement come about?
Some of the most misunderstood information about the Altamont concert has to do with the Hell's Angels. And again, slightly complicated. You have to understand a little bit about the politics of the Hell's Angels, who are a motorcycle club who in 1966 had raised the outrage of the public to the degree that the Attorney General of California declared them the number one outlaw group of the time. I mean, they were like thought of as terrorists or something. It's sort of silly, but there they were. Had a bad reputation, not entirely undeserved. They were a part of the San Francisco scene. I mean, you couldn't do a concert in the park without the Hell's Angels showing up. The Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane were friends with the Hell's Angels. The Hell's Angels San Francisco headquarters was across the street from the Grateful Dead house. And in fact, the Hell's Angels distributed the LSD that was manufactured by Owsley, who worked for the Grateful Dead as their audio guy. So they were all tangled up. And as long as the concert was going to be in San Francisco, the San Francisco chapter of the Hell's Angels would be in charge. But that fell apart. John James really, you know, blew that up. And they started moving the concert around. Now, at that point, the San Francisco chapter was no longer in charge, right? And they'd met with the people that were going to produce the concert and had an agreement that they would attend the concert as the guests of the Rolling Stones, and the Rolling Stones would provide them with $500 worth of beer. That was just a deal that Sam Cutler of the Stones made with the Hell's Angel chapter in San Francisco. By the time the concert moved to the Altamont site, well, that brought into play the San Jose chapter of the Hell's Angels. And that was a brand new chapter. It was formed that summer in June after a huge turf war with another biker group called the Gypsy Jokers. So the Hell's Angels from San Jose were a completely different matter from the Hell's Angels in San Francisco. And those were the guys who parked their bikes in front of the stage and caused all the problem. They had a lot of wannabe members that were like indentured servants, and they were acting out with pool cues. Now, one of the guys I talked to from the Angels, he was just dismissive of hell as these guys using pool cues. He thought they were stupid, that pool cues break, you can't get in close to somebody with them. He didn't think they were effective. He told me that if you really want to, you know, mess with somebody, use tire chains. And so he knew, you know, how to get violent. He looked down on the Hell's Angels from San Jose as like country bumpkins or something. And San Jose is, 100 miles from San Francisco. It's really entirely different culture. So that's what happened with the Hell's Angels that showed up there. Of course, if you've seen the movie, you've seen the Oakland chapter arrive. They had a club meeting, and they didn't show up until about 5 o'clock. And Sonny Barger, president of the Oakland Hells Angels, just took his bikes and drove right through the crowd down to the stage and took their place on the stage, sitting there watching the concert from the lip of the stage.
Yeah. Joe, if we could just, I'm just kind of intrigued by this. You know, it's the Hells Angels turf. So does that mean whatever event is happening on this turf, they're going to be there in some way? They're just doing it to make a presence? Like, just why should they have been there?
How do you stop them if you're running a free concert? You can't. So they showed up and they parked their bikes and they joined the crowd. In the case of the Altamont concert, everybody knew that the Angels were going to be there. And it was the Grateful Dead and Sam Cutler who met with the Angels to try and like make it soft, make them welcome, make it so that they had some kind of role to play besides just causing trouble.
Okay. Wow. Joel Selvin is here. He's the author of Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and The Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day. Now, we'll get into where everything begins to go wrong. But firstly, I mean, how much did drugs have to do with what went on? How many people would have been taking drugs that day? All of them?
So, you know, they think that 400,000 people were there. And I would suspect way more than half of those people were on drugs, and not necessarily well-produced drugs. This is another thing to get into the book. In 1965, when LSD first appeared in San Francisco, the people who manufactured it were kind of like missionaries, and they were very devoted to their science, and they worked really hard at making high-quality chemicals. By 1969, it had devolved into a criminal enterprise, and these chemicals were no longer being prepared by these missionaries. So there was a lot of really poisoned, crappy LSD out there. And many people got dosed by accident, drinking orange juice that they shouldn't have or whatever. And a lot of people experienced really bad psychedelic events because the drugs were just low quality. So out of the 300,000 people there, I think, 100,000 at least were on drugs. How about that for a mass toxic environment?
Yes, exactly. You're on Nightlife, Suzanne Hill with you. It's This Week in History, and we're on December the 6th, 1969, at the Free Altamont concert in California, and we're about to get to the part where things are already looking quite dicey, but they're really going to start unraveling. And so, Joel, the violence started long before Mick Jagger and the Stones even arrived. I mean, what had happened to Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead?
Well, it started with the first band, Santana. When Santana took the stage at noon, there were about 200 people shoved onto stage. I mean, there were people jammed in between the musicians. And some guy jumped up on stage from the crowd, and one of the Angels proceeded to chase him across the stage, caught him right in front of the organ player, Greg Raleigh, and beat the crap out of him. And immediately, like a difficult, tense situation went into overdrive. So right at the very beginning, there was problems. The Airplane, of course, that was just an unbelievable episode. There was a Hell's Angel named Animal. His name was Paul Hibbert, but he was known as Animal. He's wearing a dead wolf head on for the day. And he got upset at Marty Balin for trying to start. Marty Balin was the lead vocalist of the Jefferson Airplane. Marty got in between a Hell's Angel and a concert goer and tried to stop a fight. And Animal took offense at that. Knocked Marty. They took Marty backstage, which was a truck, and Hibbert, Animal, came back, and he knew Marty. They knew Animal, and Animal was crying. He was so sorry. And he said, but Marty, you know, you just can't say fuck you to an angel. And Marty, being the bantam rooster he was, he says, oh yeah, fuck you. So Animal knocked him out again. Now at that point, Rex Jackson, who was the big enforcer on the Grateful Dead road crew, decided to take out Animal. You can't knock musicians unconscious in front of Rex Jackson. And Rex took on Animal and ended up with two black eyes, knocked out cold. When Rex was knocked out cold, the stage belonged to the Angels.
Oh my goodness. So why would have any band wanted to go on after seeing all of that happen already? I mean, the Grateful Dead, they pulled out, didn't they? Said, we're not going to do this anymore.
There's a shot of Jerry Garcia and Phil Lesh arriving at the festival site. And Michael Shreve, the drummer from Santana, comes up to them and tells them that Animal had knocked Marty Balin unconscious. And Jerry, who was reeling from some massive designer drug that Owsley gave him called STP, goes, wow, bummer. They get backstage and they find Bert Kangen, who is one of their guys, works getting park permits and a real gentle, nonviolent guy. And he's wearing a bandage on his head where he's had 60, that's 6-0 stitches from getting his brains beat out by pool cues trying to stop a fight with Hell's Angel earlier. They see Bert bandaged. They see Rex with his black eyes. They get into a Metro van to have a little impromptu band meeting, and some Hell's Angel who thinks he's funny locks them in the van. So they decide not to play. And late afternoon, nothing happens for several hours while the last band, Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young, played a quick half hour and beat it out of there. They had a concert that night in Los Angeles anyway. And the temperature dropped. It's December, about 15 degrees. And the Stones sat backstage waiting for it to get dark so they could use their lights and look like the stars they wanted to be. And the audience just lost their minds.
In what way?
Oh, they'd been sitting there for 2.5 hours with no music, nothing going on, all of them on drugs, all squished together, completely uncomfortable, and now it's cold too.
So the Stones did take to the stage. How long had they been playing when Meredith Hunter was attacked? And Meredith Hunter is sort of the first person, the most famous person that we know died that day. How soon did all of that happen after the Stones started playing?
Third song.
And just talk us through what happened. I mean, Hunter had, I understand, taken a lot of drugs that day.
Hunter was what we called in those days a juvenile delinquent. He was an 18-year-old who hadn't been regularly attending school since he was 11 years old. It's a really sad story. He'd been in and out of what they call youth authority, which is juvenile jail, and had just been out that May. So he was really just getting his sea legs out there, and he was shooting speed and running around with a rough crowd. Yeah, he showed up there pretty jacked up. He'd been up all night. And he brought a gun. He went back to his car to get the gun, having forgot it when he first arrived. And he kept trying to climb up on stage. And he tried to climb up during the Stones set, and an angel threw him down. He got into an altercation with an angel who was standing in front of the stage, and he pulled out a gun. Alan Passaro, who was in this San Jose chapter, pulled out a knife that he had in his boot and jumped on Hunter's back and stabbed him 5 times, knocked him down to the ground. He walked away. A half a dozen or more angels stood on Hunter's body until some concert goers were able to prevail on them. And they carried his body up to the stage and put it on the lip of the stage. Now, the Stones have always maintained that they had no idea this happened. But I'm here to tell you, there's photographs in my book of the angels pushing Hunter's body off the stage while Mick Jagger averts his eyes, and it's all happening right in front of Keith Richards. They saw it. They knew what happened. And Hunter was taken backstage where the medical crew went to work on him. The doctor in charge of medicine that day tried to get the stones to give him the helicopter to medevac Hunter out. But he was told, no, the helicopter was reserved for the Stones. And Hunter just died backstage.
Oh, my goodness. And the Stones, did they keep playing? Or how soon did they stop?
So at that point, everything sort of breaks down for about 25 minutes. You see it in the movie, but it's only a few minutes in the movie. And Jagger decides, well, everybody should sit down. And he tells everybody, sit down, that doesn't happen. And he says, okay, let's play a blues. So they drag out a Jimmy Reed song. That doesn't cool everybody out. Mick Taylor, 22 years old, terrified, says, let's do the new song. Well, they'd been in Muscle Shoals that Tuesday, and they'd been recording three new songs. And Jagger goes, that's a great idea. So they drag out, and they play for the first time in public, Brown Sugar. Now, at that point, everything comes together for the band. I've heard the master tape, and it's just an amazing performance. Bill Wyman on bass, Charlie Watts on drums, they have the rhythm locked down. Keith Richards and Mick Taylor on guitars, they're like gears meshed together. And Jagger, who's undoubtedly terrified and filled with adrenaline, is singing so convincingly, so committed. None of that sort of loopy characterization that he tends to get into. This is singing for his life. And they do an hour-long set. They finish the Street Fighting Man, and they pack 17 people into a helicopter that holds five and get the heck out of Dodge.
Well, that's the helicopter, of course, that Meredith Hunter wasn't allowed to go in. And were the crowd during that hour, during that set, while Mick Jagger is doing his thing, do they settle down? Does it kind of, you know, turn everything into something of a trance almost?
Well, oddly enough, if you weren't in the front of the crowd, it was very possible you didn't really know what was going on. George Lucas, the Star Wars guy, at his first day on a professional film crew, messing around with a long lens at the back of the hill, trying to shoot the concert from the far away. And he and his editor, Walter Murch, drove out that day to shoot the film and drove home talking about what a wonderful day it had been, what a nice concert, and Woodstock must have been like that. So the awareness of all the violence was kind of limited to the front sections. Wow. It wasn't clear what was going on. I mean, Jagger talks to the crowd, but it's not obvious what's happening. And a lot of people just, you know, thought they went to a rock concert and that there was a little problem with technical interference early in the set.
Well, you are on Nightlife on ABC Radio. We're talking to Joel Selvin, who's the author of Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels, and The Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day. Now, Joel, another three people died that day, along with Meredith Hunter. How did they die?
Some guy climbed over a fence and fell into a canal and drowned instantly. And then there were a couple people killed afterwards when somebody stole a car and drove it through the crowd as they were leaving and crashed into a campfire. I interviewed a guy named Mac Miller, who was in that campfire and was airlifted out and arrived at nearby hospital with no vital signs. So he would have been number five if they hadn't brought him back.
So, I mean, obviously, this is a huge mess. You've had all these people die. You've had the Hell's Angels basically kill somebody in front of all of these witnesses. But was there anyone held accountable for what had happened that day?
Well, Alan Pissarro was arrested and charged with the murder of Meredith Hunter. And the prosecution showed the film that they had of Hunter pulling out the gun and Pissarro killing him over and over and over. And it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what he was trying to prove. Yeah, you know, he pulled out a gun and those guys defended their lives. And Pissarro was found not guilty. The Stones, they hit the United States like a pirate ship, you know. They did not pay any of their hotel bills or any of their car bills or any of their airplane bills. Halfway through the tour, they switched travel agents because the airlines were wanting the money from the other travel agents. So they switched to another travel agent and didn't pay that guy. Years later, like 1976, the hotels had put together a lawsuit and they were looking to get their money. And the Stones settled on the courthouse steps 7 years later.
So, Joel, who do you think is most responsible for what happened that day?
Oh, I don't have any problem with that at all. The Rolling Stones had no responsibility. They took no steps to ensure anybody's safety. They took no concern about what they were doing. It was a combination of ego and innocence that just turned out to be completely dangerous and volatile and cost four people their lives and, you know, destroyed the concert. It really wasn't a good concert. It was not a fine event. And it ended up, you know, giving them the final scene to the movie that they wanted. But really, at what cost? I mean, they've never gone back to that. They won't talk about it. They blame the Hell's Angels as if it's the Hell's Angels' fault. The Hell's Angels acted just like Hell's Angels act. And anybody that knew the Hell's Angels would have anticipated that kind of behavior. Who didn't take responsibility, who didn't pay attention to what was going on, who didn't make sure things were right, was the Rolling Stones.
Why weren't there any police there that day?
Oh, there were police.
Oh, there were, but they were powerless?
Yeah, oh, yeah. So you have to understand where Altamont is so far away from the police station that they didn't have radio communication. And they had to set up a repeater. So it was just, you know, a vacant part of Alameda County that they don't ever patrol. And they went out there that morning and they brought out guys from downtown and they took a look and they stayed on the hill and watched. And they did not have a police presence on the concert scene until after the Stones left.
So, Joel, as I said at the beginning, much has been made of Altamont. Some see it as this sort of symbol of the end of the hippie era, the end of the age of innocence. What do you think is the role that Altamont did play and how should it be seen through the rear visor of history?
Yeah, you know, it's, I hear that a lot. You know, this the end of the 60s, the dark period on the sentence, and you know, it's the final climactic moment of a cultural, political, social, and musical movement that we knew from the 60s. And it's easy to say that. It was December 1969. A few days later, it's going to be the 70s. But, you know, it didn't really end anything. It didn't end the Rolling Stones. It didn't end the Grateful Dead. It didn't even end free concerts on the hillside, you know? It just went on and the Stones continued to make records and do tours. They stopped playing free concerts. The Grateful Dead went into the studio and cut a very country-oriented Working Man's Dead album that seemed like a balm to them after this horrible experience. And the 60s, they didn't really end until 1975 when the United States Army pulled out of Vietnam. So I'm not sure what Altamont did besides, you know, create a horrible bad day for a lot of people and leave four people dead and black mark on the Rolling Stones' reputation for the rest of their history.
Now, Joel, we know that these days we would never be able to go to a concert that was that poorly organised, featuring their stars with names as big as those who were at Altamont that day. Did Altamont play some role in kind of regulating the way that concerts were performed?
I don't think so. I don't think that anybody paid any attention to it. I think that people just, like, went on. And really, you know, you can see the modern-day equivalent is, you know, like the Coachella Festival, a for-profit festival in the open air, huge crowds, remote site. It's as if Altamont never happened.
And what has made you so fascinated by what went on that day, Joel?
Well, I've been around it all my life. I did not go to the concert. I had friends that wanted to take me, and I said, no, I don't think so. I'd seen the Stones, a great show, but a hillside out near Tracy didn't seem like a good idea to me. And, you know, when I was doing my book Summer of Love in the 90s about the San Francisco music scene of the Haight-Ashbury era, you know, Altamont played a big part. All the bands were San Francisco bands except for the Stones, and everybody that was involved had a really big personal day there. So it came up in my research for that book. And to tell you the truth, it never occurred to me to write about a book about the concert itself until a book editor in New York suggested it.
Well, I'm glad you did, so that you're able to have all this detail to share with us tonight, Joel. Thank you so much for being here on Nightlife and taking us through that day.
Oh, Suzanne, it's great to be in Australia.
That's Joel Selvin. Joel is the author of Altamont, The Rolling Stones, The Hells Angels and The Inside Story of Rock's Darkest Day.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.